Welcome to the Decent Crypto Podcast. Today is November 2nd. We are here with Patrick Bush of VanEck. Thanks for being here, Pat. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Used to listening to the pod at like 1.5x, so it's odd to have everything slowed down.
Yeah, I hear that quite a bit, and I'm like, I don't even know how you can process that. Like, I can't think in 1.5 speed. I don't know how you can listen to my voice in 1.5 speed. It just seems so jarring. Yeah, we appreciate you coming on. Matt, hello. Hello. How are you?
Hello.
You guys are very excited. This is the first time we're talking. So you're actually the one that set this up.
Yeah, I mean, so Pat's been trying to get me to do the Polkadot deep dive for like over a year now.
I'm what they call a raging Pokesexual. Yeah, I used to be, but not anymore. Sorry, Polkadot.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, like I'm fascinated by your fascination with Polkadot. Like, what is behind that? Like, what's the deal there?
I think it's like, it's part of the legacy of when you first come into the space and you first land something really interesting and you see Ethereum and you see usage and you're like, okay, there's problems with this. Like, what's going to solve this? And for whatever reason, I gravitated towards some of the speeches of Gavin Wood and some of the things he wrote. And then I saw like Polkadot's framework and it just made like a lot of sense to me. To have this kind of chain concept that all connected through a bridge. And it seemed to like solve for a lot of problems that were happening on Ethereum. So that's kind of like why I liked it. And I don't know, it just seemed like non-consensus, which was probably not true, but it seemed like no one was talking about it, which probably meant like, hey, this is a big money trap, but anyhow.
When was this? Yeah.
Yeah. So I started in the space like in 2015, the boss of my company, I was a prop trader and my firm got taken over by another firm. The guy who took us over was this dude that like was a Bitcoin OG. He did like one of the follow on pizza trades. But anyway, so I got involved in that and remember like reading about the founders of Ethereum and just like learning, oh yeah, Gavin Wood like coded Solidity like over a weekend. Like, that was pretty sweet. And I kind of shelved that. And when the ICO talk for Polkadot came out, I didn't participate, but you know, I was just like looking at BTC and ETH as like an asset trade. And I just did trading of that until like 2020 when things started like taking off. And I remember like Polkadot was finally going to launch. I was like, oh, I remember this. So I started looking deep into it and how the ecosystem would go and just potential for different projects building there. And it was kind of a cool concept, this parachain concept that the projects would launch. They would actually not take your tokens, they would just borrow them, you get them back. And so you kind of lock them up in the meantime, like, you know, the project would build and do its thing. But, you know, there's a sneaking suspicion in my mind that that was in part because it allowed like the VCs to dump their dot, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
So this is like, so the parachains themselves, they have to buy tokens to lock them up in order to secure their slots, right? And so that's what you're saying.
Anyone could do it.
VCs dump onto projects?
Well, no, it was more like an argument for like DOT. Like if you just remove a lot of supply of the DOT, you have a lot less people selling. And so it was like, this helps number go up kind of stuff. And then so it was more like the DOT VCs. But I did meet a VC today that said he made a 20X on his initial investment in Akala. And Akala was a complete dumpster fire for everyone involved. Like it got hacked. It didn't work. It was slow. Part of that stems from like lack of support from Parity. Like Parity really, for lack of a better term, Munsoned it all. Does anyone know what Munson means?
No.
No, of course not. I'm like an old man. So like it's from the movie Kingpin. And Bill Murray, it plays this bowler. I think his name's Munson. And so he like ruins his career and reputation so bad that it becomes a byword for like destroying like your reputation or career, or just like just messing up really badly. It's a really good movie. It's really funny. That's a solid like under the radar, like mid 90s comedy. That's good.
I gotta check it out. So Parity really like messed with the ecosystem there. I didn't realize Parity was involved with Polkadot. I always think of it as this like Ethereum client developer.
Oh, dude, no, what? Yeah, that was like the whole entity building Parity like, or sorry, that building Polkadot, like Parity is the one, like Parity built Substrate and built Polkadot as this framework to solve for the scaling issues of Ethereum. And it sounded cool. Like, you know, you'd basically offboard data availability and execution to the parachain. So the parachain is like an L2, and the L2 would do those kinds of functions. Polkadot was the relay chain, and essentially it'd be holding the state commitments and guaranteeing them so that you could bridge across the different parachains. So Polkadot itself had no smart contract functionality. It was more a function of like all these things on it were building and have their own little parachain, you know, which is similar to Cosmos or Avalanche now. Like the concept has like been taken a lot, but you know, the whole idea was a unified bridge that brought everything together and a token that kind of powered the system and gave it security. That was the whole point.
Yeah, it was a really cool vision. I feel like the security assumptions behind the relaying and like the state commitments and all that were never like super clear to me. So it's like, is it similar to IBC where you have to just like trust both sets of validators, or like when something get like if a state gets committed to the relay, like the Polkadot central relay area, and the validators are like, actually that state never happened, let's roll it back. Like what happens at that point?
I'm not quite sure about that component. Like in the architecture as I remember it, when I haven't looked at this in a long time and it's really complicated, was essentially the local validators and the parachains, they were called collators to make sure you didn't confuse them with the validator on the main chain. And the collators would like produce their state and they would hold like the data on chain, and they produce like a commitment to a rotating set of Polkadot validators. And the rotating set of Polkadot validators would say, okay, like we're going to look at the state for the next like block or three blocks or whatever it was. And then we have like the state commitment, we have the proof, and we're going to post it to Polkadot, and we're going to have proof like the data is available essentially, right? And so from your question, I'm not sure how that would have functioned in practice. Like, because the assumption was that like Polkadot just basically had like the state updates, right? Had the changes and the functions and how it got there. But then, you know, if you wanted to like follow that trail, you had to go and see the actual transaction data on chain, right?
And so yeah, that group, that rotating group of Polkadot validators is called a Polka, right?
Yeah, hey.
I think it but is. That was like, I remember reading the white paper.
Oh, really?
Or it was like a purple paper or something. It was something really weird.
But then there was a concept of like, okay, like how do you, like to the role of concern, like how do you prove fraud? And initially there was like an entity called a fisherman in the entire operation that was like a separate kind of like fact checker that would make sure that like, okay, the data is there and the state commitments can be proven to be correct. But then that kind of like got deprecated and became a role, I think, either the collator or the validator as time wore on. But then like when it rolled out, there was a lot of issues with cross-chain communication. You couldn't quite do it effectively. So like it's argued that Polkadot also like launched its parachains too early, not to mention too slowly, right? That was a big problem also.
How did the rollout work? It was like one group at it, like one batch at a time.
Yeah. So it was again, Munsoned extremely hard. Like going back to the framework of Polkadot, it's like, okay, you have Kasama, which is their testnet, and they called it their wild, crazy, sexy cousin. And Kasama was a testnet that was incentivized by money, and you'd have like actual value to the token. And actually, if I recall correctly, the Polkadot holders actually got airdropped Kasama tokens as part of the Polkadot allocation. And so actually, like people like always shit. I'm like, oh, like the testnet having value, that's like really stupid. Like that's not a good way of doing it. And I don't think so. Like, because you go back to like Gurley ETH or any like the constructs of the ETH testnets, like there's always an issue with devs like not having the ability to get enough tokens, right? Some birdie told me that that's why Chainlink is able to get so many projects on board, because they had like a big stack of Gurley ETH and say, hey, you want this sexy, juicy Gurley ETH? Like we can help you out, just integrate. But then like it goes back to like a resource allocation problem. It's like if you have a limited resource, which is like, you know, blockchain block space, like how do you allocate it? Well, you can ration it, you can limit it, which is what Gurley ETH or any other testnets would do, or you can make people pay for it. And so that was like Kasama was like, okay, it's gonna be a testnet. But then fine, that's cool. But then the problem was like projects were expected to have a Kasama launch and a Polkadot launch. So like a lot of the projects would build both. They didn't have to, but that was kind of how it went in practice. And so they would launch on Kasama, and then have a polka dot. So Kusama started parachain auctions first, and it started them with like the first premier applications were, or chains were like Moon River, Akala, and then Shiden, which is a part of a star. And so the idea was that you lock your tokens and they'd be there for 48 weeks. And so they launched that, this parachain auction. And they were doing like five at a time. So they were doing five. And then if you were first place in the first one, the next one would be like next week or 2 weeks after that. And so like you had this very slow rollout. I think it was in part because they wanted to be careful to make sure the chain didn't break and security assumptions worked in practice. So you had this extremely slow rollout, and like the projects would launch and then people get excited, but then they'd be like, okay, what else do I do on Polkadot? And it was like, well, nothing, right? And so that was like the big issue with the launch. You wait a few weeks and it's like, okay, like now that this auction is done, when's the next batch? Well, the next batch wouldn't be like for another month. And so like theoretically, like if you think about that and extrapolate it, the whole chain wouldn't be stood up. Let's say it had 100 parachain slots, that wouldn't be stood up for like a year or 2 years or whatever. And it's like, okay, if you're trying to get this burgeoning ecosystem of value, you need people there, you need people using things, you need projects. And it's like, okay, like none of these things are operational or they're really bad user experience. So it was just a really poor launch. And then Polkadot, the same way, when Polkadot launched, it was the exact same experience. And then on top of it, a lot of the projects were just like forks and copies of things you already saw, like, you know, things you already saw forked and copied on like Binance Smart Chain or Tron. So there were some shady projects too. But that was kind of like my real disappointment. At the same time, like Parity like didn't support these teams. Like they didn't do it effectively. And they just fired, like they had 340 people total, or whatever the number is. They're down to all devs now. It's all 200 devs. So it's a big dev operation. It's like, what are they doing there? Well, they're developing the ETH client, and they're also still maintaining all the really bizarre, like arcane substrate repositories. Like that's what they're doing right now. It's like, what's their next step? And they're saying, oh, we're going to centralize this. So I don't know. It looks pretty dire, but maybe that means you buy, but I don't know. I don't think so.
Interesting.
That was a lot of Polkadot.
Wow. Yeah. That we got like the whole rise and fall of Polkadot in 10 minutes. Amazing. Okay, so like you have a ton of, like you just have a pretty extensive background in the space. Like you've been around since 2015. Can you give us like a very quick rundown of like what you've been up to in the space? You mentioned that you were doing prop trading initially. That's kind of how you got introduced to crypto. What have you been up to since? What are you up to now? Can you give us a quick rundown?
Yeah, so I did prop trading. I traded treasury bonds, and I did it like at a couple of places in Chicago and the cottage industry of Chicago, which is besides making the best damn pizza in America, is speculating on commodities and financial assets. So I did that, and then went to like a smaller shop, and at the smaller shop, eventually over time, I decided to start a crypto desk. And so that was just like simple stuff. Like, hey, we're going to do DeFi. We're just going to invest in tokens. We're going to trade and speculate. That was in like 2021 is when I convinced like the people there. I probably could have done it earlier and should have. But anyway, so we started trading. It was fine. I was at the same time still trading bonds.
It was a great time to talk people into crypto. That was the best.
Yeah.
It was easy. Sold itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good spot. And then... it was a good spot for like the time period. Everyone was so excited. And that was when SPACs were cool too. And so it'd be like, oh, do I trade crypto today or the SPAC? If I'm being really speculative. But then so, you know, I was doing like another day job, and then I had gone, so I skipped a lot of stuff. I had gone to business school and I had this business school job, and at night I was trading. And that night at night I was trading crypto. But really what that means is my business school day job was like very low echelon. I'm sorry to say that. I just didn't have any work. So I got really into crypto, and then I knew a lot. And then I saw a podcast. It was the Define podcast. And this guy named Matt Siegel was on it. And he worked at VanEck. This is like August 21. And I wanted to get in the space. And his story was like, well, I was a reporter at CNBC, And I wanted to get to the other side. Like, I didn't want to report finance. I wanted to make it happen. And so he actually had cold called a bunch of people to get into, like, eventually Kathy Wood's shop. So he eventually went to ARK Investment or whatever it's called.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. He's super smart, lucid guy. And so I was like, well, if this motherfucker could do it, like, why can't I? God damn it. Right. So that was like my response internally. And so I emailed him and I was like, hey, I heard you on the podcast, blah, blah, blah. Can I compete for a job? And he said, we're not really looking to hire now, but I'll think about you in the future. And so, like, you know, a typical corporate babble, double speak. It's like, well, that just means, like, don't, you know, like, piss off. Like, don't even bother. And then surprisingly, he reached out again in December. And he's like, hey, we have a spot open. You know, do you want to, like, compete? So then I wrote a piece on Osmosis. And so after the piece I wrote on Osmosis was like 50 pages. I even did like detailed profile on, like, Harsh, or not Harsh, on Dev O'Hala and Sonny's backgrounds and what their personalities might be like.
Wow. Oh, shit.
Yeah. And they were like, dude, this guy is on the spectrum or something. I don't know. We have to hire him.
Wait, what do you mean you did profiles on what their personalities might be like? Like, you were guessing, or?
Yeah, so it was like, you know, you typically do like a management page if you're really getting in deep investment stuff. And I also gloss over, I was a research analyst for a buy side small cap equity fund for this, like, kind of somewhat storied manager that was kind of like retiring. And then I was supposed to work there and the fund blew up. And so that's why at business school, I had to, like, find and get like I had to scramble and get like whatever job I could find because it was during COVID. So, like, I have the distinguished pleasure of graduating college in 2008, wanting to go into finance, and then business school in 2020.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. But, yeah, so then I did this thing where I was just like, okay, how do I, you know, like, what's this, like, why are these guys going to build this? Like, how are they going to stay? So, I don't know, like, who makes these things? Like, who knows what they're right about? So, did a typical kind of equity research stuff. And I was like, oh, let's just do like a profile of management. And then so, like, all I could infer was like their interviews or like how they discuss things. And so I was like, oh, it seems like they're open-minded. They're interested in stuff. They have like really quirky behavior patterns. Like, you see, like, Sonny likes to wear costumes, like, love the guy. But yeah, he's always like, so that was kind of part of the analysis. Like, what are they like? And why would they stay here? Why would they continue to build Osmosis? And that's kind of more like a venture kind of thing, you know? It's like, oh, if you get this, like, genius kid from Berkeley, is he going to stay building this project or is he going to go to Google or what? You know what I mean? So that was kind of like why I did that. But anyway, so I got hired by VanEck, and then so I've been here since April 2022 and hope I stay, knock on wood, after this really controversial interview. The whole thing has been here is I work for two private funds. One's like a hedge fund. One's kind of like, it's like a benchmarking type fund. It's not benchmarking, but it's like we're trying to match a benchmark as if you would, like, you know, small cap equities or large cap equities. And that kind of focuses on infrastructure and tooling kind of tokens. The hedge fund is an illiquid token that does anything, goes anywhere. So the idea is just to, like, you know, pick tokens that would maybe go up and then try to inform the broader investment community, like, why we think this is interesting. So, like, we did like a valuation framework in Ethereum in April, and it originally won an Atom in fall 2022. And so, like, the framework was like, it's just kind of like establishing this benchmark. Like, how do you value these things? What are you supposed to do? Like, how do you project revenue? Like, how do you estimate that? And so the exercise we worked through was like, okay, these are the logical end markets where crypto might have a presence or take some portion of revenue for whatever reason. And then we say, what's the take rate of that revenue? Like, and then how does that connect to the protocol? And then build like kind of a DCF off of that. And so that's kind of like, you know, like it's pie in the sky math. It's not meant to be like, this is the price we think it's going to be. It's more like, well, this is interesting. And here's what the potential is. And so it's like almost like, you know, like a VC type asset where it's zero or a lot based upon what happens, but you don't know. And so, like, part of the reports I write, it's like, it's really key to understand, like, There's not a probability in there. So you don't know what the base case means from our probabilistic estimate. So it's like, we can't put that in there and we don't know, but like when you value those things and you build out an EV, you do maybe a blend of those. And so anyway, so at VanEck, been writing these research reports that get public and get VanEck's name in the news, helping work through like our presence in the front. We have a really good Twitter personality now. That's not me. It's someone I know and it's a good secret. And it's fun. And just trying to help like the management team here understand as well. Luckily we have like the best CEO in the business, Jan VanEck. He's easily like, I've worked with a lot of smart people. He is very smart. He's up there and he's like open-minded and he's just like very friendly. He's a very chill aristocrat. And so that's what we're doing here. So our purpose is like, you know, we're an investment entity and we want to manage people's money and make a cut off of that. And that's what we do. And so like crypto is a new asset class. Jan and VanEck were huge gold investors. We still are. I think like 60% of our assets or some high number like that is gold or gold related to gold. And so when 17 happened and Bitcoin really started taking off, Jan's like, well, this is something that could really disrupt gold. Like we have to have this. Like this is very important, right? Like that's a core business that you'd lose. And so that's why Jan got interested in the space and just like being like an open-minded guy, like he really pushed into it.
And so is that what you're focused on right now at VanEck is kind of more on the research side? Are you still involved in, you mentioned there's like, you know, on the hedge fund side, like on the more on the trading side at all, or kind of is this like your key focus?
No, I'm all research. I don't do any of the trading. That's a separate position. And like, to be honest, to all the kids out there who are thinking trading sick and dope and whatever, like you don't want to work in an entity like this as a trader for the most part, because you don't get to take the risk yourself for the most part. Like if you want to do like trading, you got to find like a prop shop or like a bucket shop, because then you get to like do whatever you want basically. I mean, you might fail. I mean, it's most likely you'll fail, but you have to like do it. But like here, it's like trading's like, it's more of like a rote job where like PM tells you to buy XYZ, you get it done. And then you do a lot of backend paperwork. So luckily I'm doing like the research side. I get to like go to like, you know, like Telegram groups or Twitter and look up what people are talking about and see all the interesting butt jokes that people have today, you know? Mm.
So real quick for the listeners that might not know, like, can you explain why like the style of trading that VanEck does? Like if you're a trader there, right? Like somebody's calling the shots there. Somebody's actually making the trading decisions, but like what is a trader at VanEck going to be doing versus like a prop shop, or like what is that versus like a bucket shop? And then like, why are those so likely to fail?
Oh, the old timey bucket shops. Bucket shops, dude. Like, I mean, I don't know. That's kind of like that's really cool you mentioned that. It's a term that comes out of like Jeffy's Livermore and probably the best book on trading, which is Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. And it's about this guy who grew up in like the financial crises of the late 19th and early 20th century. And he just like was a random dude that figured out how to trade. He'd like watch ticker tape and he watched people like marking on the chalkboard and he'd follow the prices and he kind of figure out, okay, this is how it's getting manipulated or this is what the market thinks. And anyway, so back then, like you didn't have a broker as much unless you're like, you know, super rich and you had like one of those canes with like a big golden duck on it and you can like rap people on the head that you walk by, you know, but you go to like a bucket shop and the bucket shop would kind of like back you and then you get to speculate on the numbers. And, you know, you look at the ticker tape and you'd be buying like, I don't know, like Coca-Cola or whatever company was around back then, General Motors. And yeah, so prop shops like kind of grew out of that, but kind of didn't. But anyway, so like the essence of a prop shop is like, it's just some rich guy with a bunch of money. And he's like, okay, I used to trade. I'm going to teach you how to trade. Here's some capital. I'm going to teach you a few tricks. You got to figure out the rest on your own. And then you make money. And so it used to be like in the olden days, like if you go to like the trading floor, everyone's screaming at each other. Like you look at that madness and there's actually like, of course, like any other chaotic system that you see from the outside, there's actual order. And so typical order would be like, there's market makers, there's locals, there's people who are trading on behalf of institutions. And so like the locals would sit there and they would try to like figure out how the prices were going and then gamble accordingly. And so they would like watch the flow guys, they watch the market makers, and they think, okay, like sentiment's XYZ, I'm gonna buy it, or I know I can offload this risk somewhere else, blah, blah, blah. And so like the prop scene in Chicago grew out of like the market makers and the guys who were locals or speculators going upstairs and starting to like hone their craft and coming downstairs with like either like really good sense of the market, or they start working with like computers and like graphs and charts. And so you hear someone like, you know, Don Wilson, that's how he got big, was he was one of the first guys that really optimized like options and mathematics. And so anyways, I've explained this like whole prop scene that's taken way too long, but the idea is like in prop, like you're taking money on behalf of like the guy in your fund and you get a cut of that. So it's eat what you kill mentality. And so like you're really trying to like figure out like what your edge is. Your edge, like you understand like how to price things better, like Don Wilson did back in 1992 and Ken Griffin or whoever else. Maybe you're faster, or maybe like you understand something about the market no one else does. And so that kind of business is like very much the best take all the winnings, right? Like, so it's really hard to win that business because not only are you competing against people that are really smart, you're competing against teams of them who are really smart, who have optimized the ways of doing things. Like they shuffle the deck in such a way that they have a higher probability of winning than you. So like they don't even have to be right and they're going to beat you. Like they just have to like have better market making skills. And then they have teams of researchers, quantitative researchers that are out against you. Doesn't mean you can't win, but it's just like extremely hard to do that consistently for a long term. And so that's like the prop difference. It's like you're literally like a guy like in an office, maybe even a team of like, you know, other nerdlingers who know statistics really well. And you're like, oh, we're going to model this kind of product and we're going to see how it trades against another product, or we're going to trade a bunch of products together and whatever, right? And so the idea is just making money with the capital and then covering the expenses of your connections. But it's just hard to do that and win consistently. That's like contrasted to like people who trade flow or trade on behalf of institutions, where like if I'm prop, I'm sitting here, I don't know what's going on in the markets besides the numbers on the screen. Maybe I hear like CNBC or read Bloomberg. And the guys who are trading flow, like are guys who are trading for institutions, like they call their broker at Goldman, they call the guy at Merrill, and they're like, hey, what's going on in the market? How do you see these things? And the guy would be like, oh, well, this guy's selling $10 million of Coca-Cola stock and or whatever, right? It's not going to be like that specific, but there's going to be more of a sentiment, more of understanding, like more of a pulse. But at the same time, though, information flow, the trade-off is you're not there like making money. You're just placing orders for clients for the most part, at least in the paradigm it is now. So that's a huge difference. So like from like what you do, like how you get up, like you like in flow, you're just kind of like, okay, I'll have some trade ideas and I'll kind of like execute those and tell my clients that, and hopefully the clients go through me because I'm better at trading than other people. But in prop, it's like you have to win. You have to be one making money. Where if like the other side, it's like, oh, well, the client, you know, he places orders. It's his job to figure it out. So like at Van Eck, the guy who's the trader here, like he's just told by the PM like what to do. And maybe he does it a little better than someone else. Like maybe he optimizes his buy algorithm or how he buys in the market. So it's a different skill set, and it's a little bit harder to differentiate when you're just like a buy side guy. And of course, compensation is much lower, and then you might last longer, but it's more like, you know, a rote job.
Yeah. I mean, so traders at, you know, the hedge funds that I've generally worked at, they were much more like, you could almost call it like operational excellence, right? So it's not so much like when we think about crypto trading, it's like I take a position one side or another on a given asset, right? And it's like it's my decision making when to get in and out. In the more institutional space, trading is much more focused on the actual like market execution of the orders. And so I don't know if that's like similar to what you're saying, Pat, or
yeah, I just like, took a really long way of saying that.
yeah. And it's so the people that I work with that were traders tended to be pretty like pretty deep on like C++ and Rust and like really heavily optimizing their algos, like not just to like, you know, respond to the market accurately, but to do it like faster than the previous iteration of whatever code base they're working on.
So
it's like huge amounts of engineering going into these things. But when it comes to like the fun part, which is picking which tokens might go up or down, is that something that you wind up doing in your role, or is it like a combination of you working with a PM? Like how do you guys make decisions?
It's usually like two starting points. Like one, it's like, I have an idea. I think this is interesting. I'm going to research it more. And then the other part might be like the PM, where he's like, okay, like I want to know about this topic. Like, do we want to buy or sell based upon this? Right. Like a token or whatever. And so that's kind of like how it starts. And so I'll work through the process. Like usually, you know, you can work through like how the thing works, how a token works, like why it might go up. It's like a huge information research project, trying to figure all that out. And then like working through that and getting like a so what out of it. And the so what could be like, well, the market thinks this and we think this for this reason and that reason. So it's like, you know, writing like an essay essentially, but much more concise and geared towards like investment stuff. And so that's how the decision making comes. So then, you know, usually the process might be, okay, I have this idea, here's how it works, or the PM has this idea, let's work through this. And then we get together as a group and discuss it. And it's a really rigorous debate where people come in prepared with an idea, like they get the deck earlier, they research it themselves, and they say, okay, I agree with this or don't agree with this. And then they just hammer you, like you're just getting picked apart, where there's like, this is stupid, you know, I don't agree with this. Why do you think this way? You have to defend yourself. And that's like how typically a process like that works. It's like open debate. It's trying to distill the essence of why you want to do it, and if it's right or wrong, through just like rigorous discourse.
Have you ever had like a trade idea in the crypto space just get like absolutely destroyed? Like when you put it up for like review?
Not so far in our place. I've been pretty careful. Like I'm trying to think, like here, I don't know if I can talk about what the bad things we've done. There's things that, like, yeah, we can't talk about those, but in my personal account, I've definitely done idiotic things that weren't well thought out. Like, you know, I've bought tokens that were going up because there was a conference going on, or had some like, you know.
Wait, what? That's the right thing to do, right?
Well, if you hold it after it starts selling off and dumping, then that's not the right thing to do. Like, I, you know, the biggest one that I could talk about, because we don't have a position in the fund, is Polkadot and Kusama. Like, I was very levered and tilted at the ecosystem and had a ton of PA in it. And to be fair, like most of that PA grew a lot bigger because I had one good one work out. But then all got just like demolished, just completely like wrecked. And so that was bad because like what the problem was like going back to like the fundamentals of trading, like people disagree with this, but the way I view it is you have to come up with a thesis and you have to understand what you're looking at. And you have to like make a commitment to like when you're going to take it off and for what reasons. And that might be because you're down too much money or the thesis is wrong, but there's some like breaking point where you just give it up, right? You have to have that and you can't change it. Like maybe some people can, but I found in general, like if you start changing things on the fly, it starts to like gum up the process internally, because once you're in the mix, like you're down money and you're trading, which is typically when you say, oh no, I'll just, you know, change my thesis. That's when you can't think clearly. That's when like you start getting like upset or mentally like unable to like really cut through the BS, like you become wedded to a position. So like the worst times I've had trading in crypto and outside of it was just when like you just start justifying the position for other reasons than you had initially. And realistically, like it's a game where like you're gonna have 1,000 at bats and you want to make sure the at bats you have that aren't good, you get out really quickly, because it's like, okay, this one didn't work out, maybe I lost like a month's worth of like P&L, right? But I've had times where I lost 6 months of Pinot because I didn't like it out. And you guys say, wait, wait, Patrick, if you did something that stupid, how did you trade still? Well, you know, I was able to come back from it and I was able to like figure out like why I was wrong and trade my way to the next thing. But the idea is that, you know, you come in and you have to have like an exit point. You have to have an invalidation point for an investment, for whatever. And the biggest problem I had with Polkadot was that I'd let it continue to run against me and just like hoping it would get better or ignoring it. And it didn't really work out. And so like, again, like one of the things people do to help have an invalidation point is they have like a value at risk. And they take that and they apply it and say, okay, what's the most money that you should be down before you puke, right? And so maybe you might add like a time component, like how quickly that happens, because maybe the thing's mean reverting. If it goes down quickly, it comes back quickly. But the idea is that like you got to come in with this plan and you got to stick to it. And that might be just like an arbitrary P&L point, right? But that's kind of like how it's gone really awry for me and anyone else that I've traded with. Like, that's kind of like what I've seen too.
I think I see that a lot as well, where people get in and they might have a great trade and that, but they just have no exit plan. I mean, I've been a victim of that many times as well. Yeah, it's funny that usually the trades that end up going right at first end up losing you the most money, because you're like, wait, I was right. I can't lose money on this trade. But let's talk about a token with a conference going on that's pumping, that you just wrote a report about, Solana. So obviously this made a lot of headlines. A lot of people, I just keep seeing this headline of, you know, VanEck says Solana could hit 3K by 2030. That's obviously going to be the headline of this podcast.
you gotta have the facial expressions where you're like,
yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. In fact, I'm gonna screen grab that exact face you just made.
Yeah, you got. It's actually. You could also do like the old cuck face where like they're pointing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. Now that's gonna be our. Yeah. We have title for the rest of eternity. Now it's just gonna be you as our avatar.
I hope not, boy. It's like 2027 or the year 2027. My great great grandkids look me up, and it's like me like. Doing that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, well, they'll have like an AI like hologram of you just like doing that like right in front of them. Okay, so Solana, you wrote this report. We were just talking about it, going through it before we jumped on. It's very thorough, very detailed, very neutral as well. I think it does a really good job of kind of laying out all the possible scenarios. Can you give us maybe to start kind of what made you want to go down the rabbit hole of Solana? I'm sure you've been working on this for months. What kind of interested you about this ecosystem and why now? And let's just start there and then we can get into kind of your process.
Yeah, there's this guy I know who really likes it. And his wife's boyfriend wanted me to look at it. Because like, that's all Solana guys. They all have like wives and boyfriends. And no, I'm just kidding. We should probably cut that part out. I had to say that, dude. That was like the joke I thought of for a long time. Okay, we'll start over again. So the reason I got interested in Solana was just like, kind of going back to basics, where it's like, what are we doing here? Like, why do we have these blockchain things? Like, what is going on? And that becomes like, because I was doing like a deep dive on data availability and kind of ETH's future roadmap. And it just like became somewhat convoluted from the original message to me. And like, it's this whole change of business and it's this whole change of profitability. And it's like a really different paradigm than what initially Ethereum came out to be. Like, it's more like a polka dot now, and it's more something that's really distinct and that there really is nothing else. And there can probably only be one winner take all in that. But then like, you know, like as a user of blockchain stuff, someone who's like, you know, use everything from Aave to Akala to Osmosis, it's like, that's all that matters is the user experience. And so you know, looking at like consumer applications and things that could be built, it was like, okay, where can this be done? Like Solana, absolutely. But like, why? So that's how it kind of began, was like, we want to do something that solves for a problem for users. And it seemed like Solana was always doing that. And like people like would take issue with like the Solana phone or whatever, but it's like, that's really cool. That's like interesting. That's like exciting. That's like taking risk.
Like we tried to buy the hackathon and they literally sold out.
Yeah. And so it's always been like, to me, like if you want to have like the primordial soup to build like the sweet killer app, like you want to have some place where you can do the most stuff, the quickest, the fastest, the most potential. And sure, there's lots of problems with it. But that was kind of why I got interested in it initially. Like we've all had, like I did like a valuation on it like last summer and then it blew up, and being a Polkadot fan, I'm like, oh no, like the chief backer is gone. The, you know, like all the, a lot of the tokens that were supposedly backed got destroyed, like Soleil, BTC, whatever. And like, this looks just like Moonriver and Moonbeam dying in Polkadot when they had the Nomad hack. And so I was like so bearish on it, and the market was bearish, and then it came back. Like it survived. It was incredible, right? Like this thing was destroyed. The devs were leaving. Everyone was crying. Like Sam Bankman-Fried was going to dump like 60 million Solana tokens. And then all of a sudden it was like, no, bro, like bonk. Like totally to his credit, the raddest surfer crypto bro in the history of rad surfer crypto bros was like, no, man, like this is going to continue to go. We're going to build Fire Dancer. It's going to survive, right? And so that's like, I think, a strong narrative that you don't see elsewhere. And that's part of it. So it was those two things. What do you guys think about that?
Going back to it, can we, because I think there was a sentence at the start that really blew my mind. It came out of looking at data availability.
I was actually going to ask about that too.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I totally get it.
it was like, because the question was initially like, okay, if you have this like Frankenstein Ethereum monster, where you're going to have like this modular stack and you're going to have like Volitions or Lidiums or whatever like the new discourse and calling these things is, then you have like this really bizarre construct where it's like, okay, what's like the actual capacity to, like what's the layer that's going to break down the fastest, right? Is it going to be like transaction throughput? Is it going to be settlement to Ethereum, right? Or is it going to be something else? And so like data availability was like part of like that calculus and equation. And then it was like, you know, I saw this report by, I forget who it was, I'm really sorry guys, but they wrote something about like, you know, Solana has like super high data throughput. My PM's like, no, how does this compare to DA? How does this compare to data availability? And I'm like, well, actually, it's not the same. Like, started going down like the mid curve like route. And then it occurred to me, I'm like, no, this is reasonable. Like, if it could, like, whatever the data might be, like, that matters a lot. But if that's like the whole Ethereum Frankenstein apparatus can't replicate what Solana is, and like, what are we doing here? Like, what can be built that's interesting? And so that's why I really started.
So can you actually, let's go in on this a little bit more. Like, what exactly are the limitations there? Like, are you talking specifically about the fact that every L2 like has a different solution for data availability specifically, or like the fact that there's like things like Celestia now that like are basically their own kind of network specifically for data availability, and like Solana is kind of putting all of this data directly on chain?
Yeah.
It's like a core difference. Yeah, yeah.
It's a huge core difference because I was looking at like Celestia, and I talked with one of the founders of Avail, and like just discussing like what's a data availability problem, what are the different solution sets. So you have this like this structure of encoding it and then sampling, right? You have this like understanding like here's the data, it's guaranteed to come from the L2. So how do you keep it? How do you make sure it's there? How do you make sure none of the data is with whole health? That's like the core problem. And then how do you make sure people are able to access it? And so like that was interesting, but then it became like, okay, like how are these things comparing? How is like Celestia, Avail, EigenDA, like how do they compare? And then how does it compare to maybe like, I don't know, like an Espresso, where an Espresso or the DA is kept in each one of like the decentralized sequencers, right? And so to become like, it became this like throughput argument where it's like, okay, maybe Avail could do a block size of XYZ that corresponds to however many transactions, and maybe those transactions become become compressed in some capacity. And then it became like, okay, like, well, what are we really looking at? Like, what is this system? It's like, you have to do all these different things. Like, you have like the transaction coming through, has to make a settlement on chain. You have like certain security guarantees that change based upon what portion of the settlement you are, and then where the data availability sits. And it's like, this is a really convoluted structure. And like, the essence comes back to like, are you able to get these transactions and make them worthwhile? Are they able to interoperate? And even the L2 structure, you have to have these bridges, and the bridges have different trust assumptions. And thus you have some kind of like, you know, unified ZK layer that someone I might know might be building, right? But that was the whole reason why. It was like, there's a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense, that make more sense from like a monolithic standpoint. The modular convolutes the message. Maybe there's like a narrative we're missing where everything's modular. Everyone talks about like different components of the stack. It's like, well, back to like, you know, outside in the real world, like think about like Tesla and how it's able to do what it does versus like a Ford, right? And now I'm not exactly sure if Tesla does like make all the parts. They probably don't, but let's assume they did, right? They're making all the parts of the car, the high cost parts, the cheap parts, right? And they're putting it together, and versus like Ford, like it outsources all the part construction. So even like the high margin parts, like those are going to come and be sold to Ford, and Ford like remits it to the customer. Like from a margin standpoint, like the Tesla probably model is probably going to remit more value than maybe like Ford model. And so I don't know if that really corresponds to Solana, given its you know, focus on very cheap transactions and abundance of block space. But that's kind of like the logic I was thinking through, and I'm still not sure, to be honest. And I had these debates with my PM, but that's kind of like how we started. It was like, okay, like what makes sense here? Like this is all very convoluted. Does that make sense to you guys, or what do you think?
I mean, I'm fully on board. So like, I don't know if you listened to our hot takes of 2023 episode, but one of my hot takes is that the modular blockchain thesis is a VC scam. And the idea is like, by modularizing each component, you can have a separate token, and VCs have like a mandate to invest in tokens at like pre-liquid valuations. And that's just like a pretty good racket. And so if you have, it just gives you more things to invest in, right? As a VC. And it's part of like the privatization of all, you know, investment opportunities that's been happening in the US for like the last 20 years, right? But you know how like private equity is like some massive portion of the like aggregate investment market relative to where it was.
Yeah, now private equity is like buying like, you know, 10 person HVAC operations in Des Moines. You know? don't get me wrong, dude. Those guys are making more money than we are.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, nobody's making money.
You guys are making money. but like, it's the same thing. It's the privatization of each layer of a blockchain, and or of each component of a blockchain. It gives VCs more investment opportunities. And I've always felt that like the value add of providing short-term data presence, like that isn't permanent, isn't like stored on chain. I just feel like the value that you're adding there is so much lower that like you shouldn't get compensated that much for it relative to like permanent on-chain data storage. And you can Definitely. Obviously look at Filecoin and say, well, you're not getting paid that much for that either. But like, to me, there's always been something super important and almost like spiritual about writing data to the Bitcoin blockchain and it lasts forever, right? And like that permanence is what you're paying for. And it's what you're being rewarded for. Or right, well, Bitcoin has this weird thing where like miners don't really have to be full nodes, but you know, whatever. To me, the modular blockchain thesis, it just breaks down all of these things that made it special. And then yeah, you wind up solving problems to get around your problems. It's a little bit like
That's exactly right. That's how I feel too. It's like it's like one of the Einstein paradox of blockchain, where you solve this problem to the next problem, but this, you know, the Einstein paradox, the more you know, the less you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it feels almost like people trying to build better shocks into a car so that the car phone gets better service when like someone out there is developing a cell phone. And to a degree, you kind of do get sick of it. You're like, reject modernity, embrace tradition. Like Solana always worked pretty well. Like it broke down sometimes, but when it works, it's a great user experience.
It always
I'm
works
curious.
great, except the times when it doesn't work at all. But when it works
Yeah.
the best.
Yeah, I think my boss would probably say the same thing about me. The one question that I have is like, what do you think about the Move VM based solutions like Sui and Aptos? Do you think that they're competitors to Solana here? Or do you think like the communities are just not there?
I think they are certainly competitors, and they have very well-funded backers that want to like build an ecosystem there. And so to me, like those might have potential. Like the biggest problem with those is token unlocks, of course, and inflation. And just like the distribution of token, it's terrible. A lot of it goes to like VCs and private investors and the team. And it's not what you want out of an ecosystem. Like it seems very greedy and grubby compared to like the initial allocations you saw in crypto. Like it's completely flipped on its head. It used to be like, 10, 20% to like investors a team. Now it's like the inverse. Like that's illogical. But though they have a chance though. Like they have cool stuff. Like I don't have enough technical like depth on either like how precisely Moves works. But from what I understand, like you're building into each transaction, like you're specifying up front what state you want to touch, right? And so Move has like a lot of potential as well. Just because it's able to do like more processing capability. Like you even saw it, like I think it was Aptos. Was it Aptos or Sui? I can't remember which one. But it did like 60 million T transactions in a day during one of like the NFT launches or something along those lines. That's a lot.
Yeah, I think that was sweet.
That's the highest
Yeah,
I've
I mean,
seen of anything.
yeah. I guess that is like the extreme version of like, well, I don't know. To me, it's also like how much block space do we need for the current state that we're in, where 60
No,
million
it.
transactions. Hey, like what is that block space filled with on something like Sui, right?
Yeah, even Solana has that problem. Like you see, it has like 300, 300, 400, 500 TPS. And like most of that is people trying to take advantage of the way like Solana's architecture works. And so, as I understand it, and I've talked to some of the people at like Umbra Research and Jito. And the essence is like it has like three pipelines that process transactions in parallel. And so, at the initial ingestion portion, like there's no real separation about what those things are trying to do. And so when you barter transactions, like you're trying to like hit one of those ingestion, those three ingestion points in order to get access to the state right you want. So that just means you're basically like spamming transactions to the network because you think one's going to slip through. And you get like the arb or the background or whatever. And then people are doing that probabilistically based upon like where the node is located, where they're located, where the RPC endpoint is, what they're trying to do. Like you go back to like when I was a trader at CME, like there is these different connections to the exchange, the CME exchange called iLink. So not only did you have like a colocation of a server, you had like a message pipeline. And so people would probabilistically guess like, okay, which one's fastest? And then the game theory came in like, okay, if this one's fastest, what about during like a high contention state? What if there's like tons of trades going on? It's like NARM farm payrolls. So everyone's gonna go to the fastest one. Maybe you want to go to the medium one, right? And then how do you send those messages? Like how do you do all that? And so like that kind of like relates back to like the transactions on these chains where it's like, the block space is priced so cheaply. You're effectively allowing people to do like a lot of spam to just make like, a few cents because it costs you like 0.002 cents, right? So it's like, okay, well, like goldfish grows to the size of its bowl, people will do things, go for arbs until the cost of that arb. And so that's like what you're seeing in like Move or Aptos or Sui. And that's like that's one of the problems. It's like you need to have a balance between like the civil versus like the block space costing too much for cool activity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll probably see this with layer twos as well, but it'll be much weirder, right? Where like Solana has an interesting, like complicated transaction, like forwarding model where like your transactions only go through to like the next three block producers or whatever. And to your point,
yeah, there's like next three leaders.
Lanes they can go through. Yeah, next three leaders. And I'm sure if you're like specialized in, like, it's like you were talking about with like being on the floor, right, of the exchange, and like everyone's shouting and it looks like just kind of chaos from the outside. But from the inside, if you're going to the floor every day, if you're like actually routing these transactions, mapping out the networks, and you know geographically where the leaders are, like then you probably have like a very intimate knowledge and you can make money there. Whereas with like the layer twos, they're like single venue, right? Like with, I'm sure, global load balancing, but I'm sure there's like little things to do better or worse there, like when you're trying to submit an ARB transaction or something.
Yeah, but dude, and that's assuming a neutral entity. And so that's a key assumption. Like even back to the Meyer days, there was off-chain agreements, like, hey, my order is coming through, put me in front. And so something like a Solana, like there's potential, and I don't want to speak to this too much, this is not 100% sure, this is more of my like supposition, that there are entities that like, because it's continuous, like have like a little patch on top of whatever Solana client you run, that give them like a first look at the transactions coming through. That's my supposition. Yeah. And then like they can insert their own transactions because it's so fast. It's so continuous. It's not like, you know, a 12-second block where, okay, I have time to work through what's going on. Okay, I'm going to bid XYZ gas. Everyone else is going to do it, you know, whatever, right? On Solana, it's like there seems to be a latency advantage inherent in that. And because of that, you probably have some sort of relationship with trade entities that is able to see like the flow. And I don't know what they do with it, to be honest, but that's kind of like my you know, like applying logic to what I kind of understand or learn, but like you, I'm cynical.
I mean, also the fact that like that a trading entity wrote the client, I think could give us a little bit of a push in that direction. How important is FireDancer? I saw in your report, it says something like it's like a 10x increase in like throughput. Is that real? That seems insane.
It might be even higher than that. They showed something along the lines where their six-threaded processor could do 6 billion TPS. That was what one of Kevin Bauer's presentations was. Kevin Bauer's is the guy from Jump. He's like the super giga quant genius that used to take all my fills in trading, probably. but yeah, that's what it says. I don't know. I don't know like how it works technically, and I'm not a very technical person, though I try to be. And yeah, that's what's coming out, and I'm excited about it. But you know, it's like anything else. Like, go back to like early days. Like Avalanche was advertising like, you know, 10,000 TPS using their DAG system in Goon's basement. Mm-hmm. So who knows like what this would be?
Just speaking of Avalanche, real quick, and then maybe we can wrap with your hot take. Do you see any path forward for Avalanche from here? Like, you know, I try to ask everyone in the space about this because I just haven't been in that ecosystem for so long.
So Avalanche is taking an interesting nuanced finance approach. So they're looking at like people who are making so what's for businesses that want to build on Solana Avalanche, like TradFi. And so like, that comes from like the subnet architecture where all the entities that want to build on blockchain, they want to have some control over it. Like if you go back to like what JP Morgan or Goldman, I forget who it was like the problem with blockchain is if the transaction gets messed up or something happens, I don't know who to sue. And so that was always Stellar's use case, is that we had this federated chain, right? You have everyone like who wants to run a node can run one, but you only trust certain nodes. And so that was kind of like the so what that applies to Avalanche, in the sense that, okay, so like you have the subnet architecture, you have to just validate the CEP and X chain, but you can do it into your own chain and you have to stake Avalanche to do it. And now they're taking that restriction off. And so when I talk to like VC guys, they're like, yeah, all these people, like they don't want to spend X thousand dollars like on the Avalanche. And that's really the impediment. But that's not really true. What the impediment was for a lot of TradFi entities, they want to build on like a chain. They don't want to hold a token. They can't hold a token. Like who holds it, right? How does that work legally? Like that's a really bizarre construct and a poor user like pain point. Like I have to hold this fluctuating value token. Like how do I justify it to shareholders if I want to experiment? And that's like, you know, like not a lot of money, but it still matters from a legal standpoint. You can't custody that. And it might even be a security, right? I don't remember like precisely how they came out on the Avalanche, but I don't think any securities deal, but someone in Washington might, and that's another issue. And so what they're trying to do is build a bunch of so what's for traditional finance for reasons like how they tokenize and when it happens. And then like they have the ability to run your own subnet that takes advantage of that. And so that's kind of actually a differentiated like way of going about it. Now, I don't know the probability of it actually achieving success, but they're trying really hard. So there's people building interesting things. One example would be like, let's say you tokenize like a money market fund, right? There's a lot of different ways to do that. Like you could do it like a dozen different ways and none of them all could be able to interoperate with each other. So like, say like I'm like super dope hedge fund trader and I want to trade like these 10 money market funds are all different on chain. Well, they might be encoded in different kind of smart contract standards. They might have a different token standard. They might have a different way of like remitting value of that asset on chain, right? And so from like a back-end standpoint, like how do you reconcile that? Like, okay, I have like part of this and part of that and part of this. Like, yeah, okay. Like us as like users, we see the money on chain, but from someone else, like from an entity that needs to like, you know, calculate P&L, they need to understand all those components. And so the point that I'm getting at is that like Avalanche is going at this through like this like high finance kind of vector where like, okay, there's all these things that need to be done for tokenization to happen, all these reasons why entities want their own blockchain. And that's kind of like their pitch and their approach. And will they be successful? I'm not sure. I don't know. And how does that compare to other things? Like it's definitely not as favorable to, particularly for like the token, because then it's like, why do you need the Avalanche token in this? Like why do you need AVAX? Like, I don't know. Like, I remember arguing with like someone there and I was like, look, like your subnet architecture doesn't make sense because you only need like, you basically for each subnet you needed 2000 per validator, 8 validators minimum was kind of like what the understood standard was. You could have done less, but so that's like 16,000. It's like, okay, well, you know, whatever the floating token supply was, it was substantially lower than that. You need like tens of thousands of that to be a logical sync. And if no one's using C chain and paying for transaction fees, like why do you need the token? And so that's when it comes into like play, like, well, like an entity like Avalanche has two different kinds of components. There's actually Avalabs and then the Avalanche blockchain, the token. And the Avalabs, they have equity, like they accrue equity value differently. Yeah. It doesn't always relate to the token. And so there's kind of always like in a lot of these labs entities, like we've seen this kind of play out with Uniswap, there's an interest that may conflict with token holders, right? And that's always been something that confused me in this space I never got, right? Like, what are these labs corporations doing? And so what they're doing is they're going to be the chief service provider for that blockchain. Like, once they decentralize, quote unquote, then it's like, well, we're going to be the one that, you know, builds the next thing and then the blockchain pays us. Like, how that happens, like, through a vote, it seems kind of convoluted and tough given what we know about on-chain governance. But that's the model. So, like, there's lots of different entities that do that. I don't want to say them all, but that's like very common. Like probably even Parity was like, Parity was like, hey, we got Polkadot. Okay, like token's sweet. We own Polkadot. But hey, you know what? Like if you're like Siemens and you want to build a parachain, like you don't know how to do that. Like you don't know what substrate is. Hey, guess what, Siemens? Like we got 200 engineers that know substrate in and out. We're going to build this for you. You control the validator set, make it do what you want to do. That so like that's like always the issue with these entities, these labs with these tokens. That's like the problem that I've seen. But yeah.
Interesting. They generally all operate that way too.
Yeah.
Like it's basically across the board.
Not Polygon. At Polygon we have no revenue. We are actually just a foundation. Nobody has equity interest. It's just like we are just here for the tech. So we partner with like dozens of implementation partners, and they're the ones running that racket. It seems like from an investor standpoint, like an easier pitch to make in a pitch deck to VCs that like, hey, we're also going to have this like equity entity, and it will have like revenue streams from like running, you know, software building. With Cosmos, it was different. They spun out like all these different, there's like three or four or five like service provider entities that are sort of just like competing for grants from the hub. Nine. So it's decentralized, I guess, even though it's still like software services revenue models.
Well, it's like the Tendermint thing is like a little bit different because like Tendermint, the entity, like ran by Jay Kwan, everyone just didn't like that guy. Like people have a lot of negative opinions on that man for some reason. He seemed perfectly reasonable, given his, I don't want to say anything. No hot take. No, I don't want to say negative. Everyone's already going to hate me for shitting on Ethereum. The entity like broke apart, and like you have like Zucky, you have like Jack Zamplin, you have Ethan Buckman, and they're all like kind of building their own kind of little projects. Like Buckman has like, as I think he has the ICF, if I'm correct. And so they're all kind of like have different roles in how they're, you know, helping people develop Cosmos changes in Cosmos SDK, or how they're like, you know, building things for the hub, right?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's just a completely different land, Cosmos. We like to ask each of our guests for a hot take. And I pinged you, I don't know, like 7 minutes. So we did a better job this time. I pinged you 7 minutes before the episode asking for a hot take. Last time we just sprung it on Jack at the end of the episode. Do you have any hot takes? You've dropped some for sure.
My first hot take is Almond Joy is the best Halloween candy.
Wow.
Oh, supremely
hot take. Wasn't expecting this one.
Yeah.
Not what do you guys fan? Think?
I'm not an Almond Joy guy. I got into almonds themselves like past the point of when I was going trick-or-treating. So maybe I'll like them now, and I haven't had one since ever. So maybe I will like them now. I don't know.
Yeah, well, if your life reminds you of watching paint dry, there's Crispy Almond Getaway. That's Almond Joy.
Okay, what's the next hot take?
Well, I think we're into controversy. And because of that, I want to stir the pot. I have a lot of problems with Chainlink and Chainlink's model. And I've told people a lot of this in private, and I think the point at which it all comes together is its business model is based upon trust. It's trust that they have data, that the data is valuable, and that the token accrues value from this data. And I think in each component, like, those things are not necessarily true. I don't think that you can trust where the data comes from because you don't know the source. You don't understand the latency of the data. So I don't think the data has value. And so going back to like trading, like think about like data feeds. The CME makes like, I think it was like 1/6 of this revenue on data feeds. And so I was like, what do you need a data feed for? What does data feed do? Well, data feed exists so you can build financial products or you can trade off of it. And so depending upon your use case, that level of data has different values. And accordingly, CME charges higher value for higher or lower latency data, right? So if you have like a ticker on your ETF, it's going to be a bit lower cost than if I'm like a high frequency person trying to squeeze like, you know, half a basis point out of like a 30-year cash bond. And so that value proposition comes from like, you know, one, the data, but two, also like how fast you get it and like how sensitive it is at time. And I think with respect to Chainlink has this usage for like, you know, the very high latency things. Like, yeah, it makes sense. Like you want to have your DeFi pools have data and prices, but the most valuable component of that, like the overarching most valuable component of that is like being able to trade off that data. And I think that in the sense, by the time that data gets to the chain, there's parties that already have known that data and acted on it. And those parties may or may not be in concert with some of the chain like oracles. Like you don't understand like how those OCAs exist there. And from the standpoint of like a trader, like I can make a market, I'll take the market, I'll know I took the market before everyone else in the market knows, and I will be able to act on chain accordingly. So then going back to like the value of that data, like I think the value of data is quite low, like because you don't know where it's from, it's not very sensitive, and it's not all that useful. And I don't see what someone else can like, you know, change that, or sorry, can replicate that. The other component is that essentially the other component is that the token itself like doesn't really like have much value right now. And like that's so important. Like, okay, so they're gonna like you're gonna stake the token, and eventually the token feeds will give you portions of the revenue. But then you like you have this trust model that you're building that the Chainlink token needs to back these validators. And so if that trust model breaks, like okay, then that token's worthless. And then compare that to like an ETH or some other kind of model where you don't have a token backing that, or a token that like doesn't relate directly to the value, then like you probably want to trust that more because there's not the incentives to cheat as much. And if it breaks down, it's not going to blow the whole system up in the same way. And so that's kind of like my two problem vectors with Chainlink. So I think it's like, and it's like, you know, no one solved the Oracle problem too. That's kind of like my hot take.
Oh, okay. Wait, so when you talk about the breakdown of trust and the staking of the token, what like is that people just like blatantly submitting misinformation to the chain regardless of like what the token what it does to their stake? Or
it could be like if you're able to consistently lie and make money off like some other agreement that doesn't like necessarily deprecate your chain like token value, then you can do it. It's kind of like salami attacking like Chainlink's Oracle network just through maybe having a little bit of a slower price feed coming on chain, or maybe it's like you report the price a little differently. Now, of course, like Chainlink is a model, we're like, okay, we come together and we decide this, but what if you control like a big portion of the model? Like that's the other part of the problem. But also like, what if you're able to subtly influence it? And that's like the issue that I also have. So there's, I think there's just like a lot of holes in the design for it to actually emit value. And then like, you know, if you run an extrapolation of how much TVS it has today, like it was something like it was 16 billion. And when we extrapolated to like 1 trillion, like we couldn't get, if we extrapolate its current like take rate on like how much revenue goes through data feeds that goes through all the other products they have, If you brought to like, you know, a trillion TVS, and that number was something like 1 or 2 trillion. I think it was closer to 1. But it's like that's a lot, right? That's awesome. Everyone in the Link community like would be posting frog memes, like sitting in like, you know, comfy chairs, like sipping cocoa. But like from a valuation standpoint, if you have an $11 billion fully diluted valuation, that's an 11x revenue multiple. That's not a great framework for an exit. That's not like a great terminal value. And so people will be like, oh, well, there's CCIP and there's all these other businesses, but you still go back to their trust model. The trust model rests upon their Oracle network, which is a federated network right now. People have to be approved to be in there, and the token backing that. And that's like a very flimsy model. That's like, it's like essentially similar to Terra in some standpoint where, you know, if you have some violation of trust of that model, and the whole thing breaks down. Like it's akin to like false vacuum decay. Right? False vacuum decay is this idea that like, okay, maybe the vacuum of space really isn't at the minimum it should be. Like maybe like physically, like we're just in some kind of like suspension where we're like something triggers it and we get to the real vacuum decay, then all physics blows up, right? And that's kind of like the premise of like, you know, why a lot of things might not be what they seem is how I'm going about it.
Wow.
Does that make sense? Did I just like make some kind of nonsensical argument?
No, I think it makes sense. The question I have is, do you think this is like just a broad problem? Like, is this just like an Oracle problem, like in crypto, or can it be solved?
I don't know. Potentially, like it would seem like it's like the problem with Chainlink is the data has to compete in the gas auction too. Like the data is going to a mempool and you get to see what that is. And so like it would make more sense if the validators themselves like were able to get that and like put it either top of the block or like had some way of agreeing upon that data rather than having an outside entity. Because again, like from a trust model standpoint, you're trusting like, you know, Chainlink's network of nodes and this token value. And you, for something like a price feed, like maybe you want a higher value of trust on that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Terra did this, right? And I think like it's easy to hate on Terra for all sorts of reasons, but I thought it was like genuinely like innovative having the set of Oracle transactions at the start of the block so that it knows what the price of Luna in denominated in USD is, right? That was really cool. And that's unfortunately the exact kind of thing that I feel like Solana sacrifices relative to the modular blockchain stuff is like the ability to innovate on the use cases for block space in a more customizable way. But maybe the Solana transactions are just so cheap that it doesn't matter. And we really should be looking at it as more of a stream than a like block by block, like chain.
Yeah. And like to the point where like the chain, like Oracle prices and had their issues in the past, like if I recall correctly in 2020, like there was a lot of discussion that Chainlink Oracle prices didn't arrive on time when there was going to be a large liquidation in Maker. And because they didn't, that liquidation never happened.
Yeah. 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 I remember this as well.
And so it's just like this odd trust model that, I don't know, can Oracle problem be solved? It's something I don't know. And is Chainlink the best solution right now? It probably is. Like, let's be real. Like, but I don't like it like long term. So that is a hot take.
Wow. Very hot.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that. Well, yeah, Matt, you got anything else? This is great. I learned a lot.
Yeah, me too. Polkadot season is almost back. This is what I learned. Run it back.
Well, yeah, Patrick, thank you for coming on. This is a pleasure. Got to pick your brain, got to learn a lot. We'll have to have you back on in like a year or so to see how everything is held up and what other reports you're working on and, you know, dig in again.
Yeah. Hopefully we're all here in a year from now. Then I'm not on like the Garbage Man podcast talking about new innovations and, you know, taking out the trash.
I mean, they're eating better than us right now.
Yeah, people, when six figures made was a lot of money, people were making six figures as Garbage Man near where I grew up. It's like, what? Really? That's awesome.
I mean, going through crypto Twitter today, it's wading through trash anyway, right?
That's a good description of my job. Yeah. Just looking
for
gold.
We're all garbage.
Hey, this pizza right, box cool. called Uniswap yeah. has.
I love the pizza book. Cool. Well, thank you again, Patrick. This has been Decent Crypto Podcast. We'll be back in a few days to cover everything that happened this week. Till next time, stay decent.